wrath of God. In relationship to a series on faith, what in the world does the wrath of God have to do with anything to do with faith? Anything? Did it do anything in your understanding regarding faith, God, your relationship to God? Well, what is wrath? What did you see about wrath on Sunday, if anything? Ron?
Wrath isn't something that's reserved for a later date. It's something that's in a belief we are into right now. We're walking in right now.
Okay. You're under it. Yes. And then. Now. Not just a day. Not just a day. It is also a day, but it also begins when sin occurs. Anything else? Okay.
It's the result of justice.
Result of justice. Would you tie that together, kind of just explain that a little bit?
Well, God being a just God is going to for lack of a better word, take care of the righteous, the ones that obey God and do what is right and obey the commandments, and they will be taken care of by going to heaven, and the sinners that do not obey the commandments are going to be dealt with in a just manner, which will be helpful.
Okay. So justice would separate the sheep from the goats, good from the evil, and they will not dwell together through eternity. Okay, somebody else want to draw in other aspects of justice in that regard?
To benefit his kingdom.
It's to benefit his kingdom.
In that, for governmental purposes, that you must execute justice or his law would just be advice. We must have punishment.
Okay, so God's purposes and governmental purposes necessitate that justice move, be exercised. Can you give me a closer connection between justice and wrath? Greg, you have something?
This is considered as high as good.
To have justice operate?
Or, if wrath was what was needed, it was because it's the highest good.
Wrath. So you're pointing to wrath when you say that?
Or either one. Whatever is the best good for his kingdom is what he will administer.
Okay. Articulate for me somebody the connection between wrath and justice. Are they the same thing? Wrath and justice, is it the same thing? What's the difference between the two, or the relationship between the two? Kim?
Remember you said that wrath was the most just thing that God can do when there is sin, and people think that it's unjust for God to be upholding his law by punishing, but it's actually the most just thing.
Okay. Greg?
Wrath would be more justice. The other is mercy. I mean, it's mercy. What we deserve is his wrath. Out of his mercy, we are not given his wrath. But that's what we deserve.
Okay. Well, what's the connection? What is the distinction between wrath and justice? Can you have justice without wrath? Can you have wrath without justice? What's the connection between the two? Ron, what are you feeling?
Wrath is not out pouring this justice. If you have justice, you can have wrath, but you can't have out of justice becomes, as Greg was saying, mercy and wrath. So wrath would be an outpouring of God's justice.
Out of,
they're not synonymous.
Okay. But mercy wouldn't come out of justice.
Mercy triumphs over justice.
Mercy triumphs over justice, but it would not come out of justice. Okay. Opposite of justice is mercy.
I guess I was trying to say wrath may be a response of God's justice.
Yes. I think I said Sunday morning it is an exercise of justice. It is when a governor who is committed to justice sees the outrageousness and the character of sin, it is a response in the governor. It is the exercising of the mind in the governor that it wells up into wrath, that is, a total displeasure towards the sin, and only one who is just would have the kind of wrath without sin. There are other people who have wrath filled with sin because it is a, would call it a selfish wrath, or simply a rage that their selfish interests are not being served. God's wrath is not selfish at all. It's not his selfish interests that are not being served. That's why he's full of wrath towards the sinner, but that the greatest good is not being served. He has no selfish interest that he serves. He serves the common good, the great good, public good. And when that is not being served, then he is filled with wrath because he aims only at good for its own sake. And if you've ever gotten a glimpse of selfishness and seen its outrageous character, you've gotten a taste of the wrath of God towards sin. Just a taste. Tonight we're going to talk about justice. You might say to yourself, I thought we talked about that Sunday, since I talked about wrath. And there is a connection between wrath and justice. Tonight we're going to talk more specifically about justice. And it is an attribute of benevolence or love. You're going to see a hope a lot more than just wrath when we talk about justice. A whole lot more. Justice is something where the word justice is said, people start to, their knees start to shake and they get just a little apprehensive because it is believed that will inevitably lead to wrath. And it does for the sinner. But it's an attribute of love. So justice abounds in heaven where there is no sin. So even in heaven where there is no sin, justice reigns and no one is fearful of it because it is an attribute of love. And to be a just person is to have that attribute as part of your character. And the scriptures say, blessed is the one who is just. We might say, blessed is the one who is merciful. You might be able to understand that. But to comprehend, blessed is the one who is just, is the same thing as saying in kind, blessed is the one who is merciful. It is an attribute of benevolence, just like mercy is, or grace is, or the things that we would naturally assume would be benevolence. Justice is as much benevolent as any other attribute of love is. It's just as blessed. It is just as beautiful. It is just as wonderful, just as something to praise and is praiseworthy as mercy and grace is. Now, justice can be just a mere feeling. Can be just a mere feeling. We are constitutionally made to dislike injustice. And injustice is something that can be seen every day in the newspapers, on television news, or observing relationships that you know. You can see injustice. And this sense of injustice can be an involuntary feeling that arises in the mind when it sees an unjust treatment between two people, or an unjust cause that is touted highly, such as the civil rights movement, appeal to people's sense of justice. It is not just that human beings of a different color are treated with a different dignity or respect than other human beings of a different color. That is not just. That is just not fair, is the argument. And it was not hard to appeal to a large number of people that that was not fair. People who had prejudice because of another person's skin color would have arguments that it was fair, but it was only their prejudice speaking. And so you can gather people on your side if you can appeal to their feelings and their sense of justice and injustice, and they can become greatly enraged at the sense of injustice that they see. And it could be a large-scale thing like civil rights, or it can be an individual thing like the treatment one person is receiving of another. You might read about it in the newspapers, and your sensibilities could be enraged by that. Now, the sensibilities can be so enraged, the feelings can be so heightened and strengthened, that a person willing to be moved by those feelings will join a lynch mob, will join a crusade, will alter their whole life and start crusading for a cause, a just cause, and devote their energies and times and efforts to following that because they're moved by their feelings. And they are moved to indulge those feelings and to live in those feelings and be moved by those feelings. But that is just as selfish as if they were the ones perpetrating the injustice, because they're only moved by their feelings. They do not have as their end to promote justice. They have as their end to indulge their feelings of outrage, to let them have free course and indulge in them. Teresa?
I think a good example of that is the recent what's been happening in the anti-abortion thing. Someone can justify killing the doctor because the doctor performs abortion. That would be a person moved by the sense of injustice to the unborn. The very same person, you know, went around and then
not taking
the life of someone
else. That's my example. Exactly right. That this man, in the name of pro-life and defending the life of the innocent, takes a life and brings down upon the cause of pro-life great dishonor. Because it's a contradiction in terms. Take a life. To save a life. Their argument is, this man is taking a life. We're against people taking lives. But to take the law into your own hands and kill that man who you believe is taking a life is the spirit of lynching. That is the spirit of the lynch mob. String him up. Take your law into your own hands. It doesn't matter. Courts. It is flaunting government, it is flaunting law, it is flaunting the judicial system. It is saying, I determine what is right and law here, and to take that man's life is totally lawless. And obviously moved, in my opinion, by his feelings of outrage. But it would not be a benevolent act because he's flaunting. He's flaunting the law in all of its aspects. That would be a case of injustice because it's a total disregard for law. Though in his frame of reference, it was a just act, as he has expressed it at least. So that means cannot be justified by the end that he says. It could not have been chosen as a means to the end that he claims, because the end could not possibly embrace something that is purely out of the sensibilities and the flaunting of the law. It's a wonderful example, Teresa. But justice, to be an attribute of benevolence, must be a willingness. It must engage the will according to the reason and not just the willingness according to the feelings and sensibilities. So let's try to develop our understanding tonight. Everyone has a sense of justice. God has made us constitutionally to have a sense of justice. That is why everyone can sit on a jury and have a sense that there has been an injustice done by somebody who might be on trial. The very idea of karma. Karma is an idea of Hinduism. Karma says in this life, that you, as you live this life, if you're doing really good deeds, you're building up less karma for the next life. So in the next life, you have less karma to have to sort of neutralize or something. And if you're doing great evil in this world, you come back in the next life with a great deal of karma or some kind of baggage that you have to deal with in the next life. Well, that's a form of justice. It says that how you live in this life, justice says you've not been punished enough in this life for the evil you've done. Therefore, at some time in the future, there needs to be a future life where justice handles your wickedness in this life, so that justice can be served, at least eventually over long periods of reincarnation. Justice is served until that karma, that building up from evil things, is finally dealt with. Justly so. And then the person doesn't have to come back again. It's out of a sense of justice. Now, justice is an attribute of love and of benevolence. Justice is concerned about the penalties of the law being executed and seeing that a person is treated according to what he deserves. Now, there are distinctions to be made in justice. One is public justice. That is the concern for the public good, the public well-being, the public interests. It always insists that the greater interests of the public prevail over the lesser interests of an individual. This is very common. We all understand those kinds of concepts. This is the problem with the lobbyists in Washington, D.C., is it not? Is that not the complaint, that a particular special interest gets up enough money and hires a clever enough person to go into Congress and get a bill passed that only benefits their business or their interests and not the general public interest? So that the public funds are spent for a private interest instead of the public good? And that kind of concern is raised often. And it is going on all the time, but it is not, the concerns are not raised often enough. But it is recognized that that is not a proper interest to serve with the public funds and the public interest. Public justice demands that penalties for law breaking are executed unless something can be done that makes it possible to not penalize the person and yet maintain law and order and the authority of law. Then there is retributive justice, or retribution, or vengeance, personal revenge. This is the Hatfields and the McCoys. You've killed my daughter, I will kill your daughter. This is retribution. This is based upon personal justice. The man that killed that doctor is operating under his own sense of retribution. He personally was offended, and they personally killed that other person. He took the law into his own hands on a personal basis. This has nothing to do with public justice. Then there is a sense of commercial justice. There are other forms of justice, but these three are important for our study. Commercial justice is willing exact equivalence. It is uprightness in business. It aims at commercial honesty, at domestic integrity and tranquility. Give me some examples of commercial justice. Give me some examples of commercial justice. You deal with them all day long, every day, and do not take recognition of what they are. Go ahead.
Say, like, fee for service, something like that. If you provide a service, you expect an appropriate fee for what you provide. It's commercial justice.
Okay. Let's go with someone. So you have a sign in your door that says this service is $35, and they pay the $35 when they get the service. That would be commercial justice. Okay. What if they gave you $30 and the fee was $35?
Payments.
But the agreement was $35 when they're done. And then they gave you $30. Would that person be just? Okay. What are some other examples of commercial justice? Huh?
Copyright laws.
Okay. Now, have you ever heard of the Department of Weights and Measures in the U.S. government? You heard of that? What do you think that's for? What do you think we have a Department of Weights and Measures for? Greg?
To standardize
weights and measures. So if you get 12 ounces of something, you really get 12 ounces of something. That somebody's ounce over here is not the different size than somebody's ounce over here. So when somebody says ounce, everybody's going to understand ounce means X amount, and that is determined by the government and set by the government. And when they manufacture scales, those scales are set by the government and sealed by the government so that a person gets true weight when they buy. When you go to the store at the market, if somebody tampers with those weights so that a pound of carrots weighs 1.5 pounds, the government will come in and sue them and pursue commercial justice for the community so that if they pay for a pound, they get a pound and they're not charged for 1.5 pounds. The Department of Weights and Measures makes sure weights and measures are true. They are operating and overseeing commercial justice. And God commanded Israel that they make sure that they had, for example, you shall have a full and just weight, you shall have a full and just measure. We're talking about the same thing. Now, we're talking about weights and scales and stuff like that, right? Here we have a scale. You shall have a full and just weight and a full and just measure. Here we have a 1 pound weight, and you're going to buy 1 pound of barley. So you put the 1 pound weight on here, and you start putting barley in until these balance out, and then you've got 1 pound of barley, and you pay for 1 pound of barley. That would be a just weight, a just measure. However, if you do this 1 pound weight, you kind of go in the back and drill a hole in it. You put it on here. And then you start pouring in the barley, and it says 1 pound, but it's 15 ounces. Well, you just increased your profit by about 8%, something like that. That's done. It's done even today in countries where it's done by hand or where they can get away with it. It's been done throughout history. This is an injustice. This is a commercial injustice. Justice that we're talking about has a great deal to do with this. A great deal to do with this simple concept of scales. What is a symbol for justice? At least one of them in our country. Have you ever contemplated it? Yeah.
The lady with the scales, but she's blindfolded.
Okay. We've got a lady holding scales, but she had the blindfold on. Why does she have a blindfold on? Kim? Show impartiality. She's not concerned with who in the world she's dealing with. Just justice. Just to make sure that there is justice, that the scales are even in all dealings. So it doesn't matter who comes to Miss Justice, Lady Justice. She's not concerned with who it is. She's not concerned whether it's Bill Clinton or Dennis Carroll. She's concerned that we both get just treatment, just contracts, just transactions. Okay? Other examples of commercial justice that you, I'm sure, have not thought about it, but you deal with it all the time. Many examples. Commercial justice, Pat?
Well, I think that every time I go to the store and I get my groceries and I give them money and a transaction, commercial transaction, and it's just.
Okay, that's commercial justice if you're getting what you pay for. I'm not talking about whether you think it's worth the price, but you paid the price voluntarily and the price was known to you, so you got the item that you knew the price ahead of time, and when you got up there they didn't say, oh, I know it says $1.15, but it's really $1.25. You paid what they asked for, and that's commercial justice. Bob? Okay.
I was going to say something similar to that. Truth in advertising.
Okay. What else? Even more concrete, more daily in what you deal with. You actually deal with. Not observe, but you actually deal with. How many pay rent?
amount that you owe in rent or mortgage
is what you agreed to pay, is it not? And you agreed to pay so much, and if that man or that person or that company comes to you at the first of the month and says, you don't owe that, you owe $25 more. That is not commercial justice. That is injustice, because it is contrary to what is agreed upon. In the same way, if the first of the month comes and you do not pay your rent or your mortgage, and you call that person up and says, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to pay, or I'm sorry, we decided to go on vacation last month and we don't have it to pay. That is not just. That is commercial injustice. You see that? Every one of your bills that you contracted for and have a bill for, you owe as certainly as God is just to pay that as agreed. And to not do so is to be unjust. Just as absolutely. All of our transactions like that have to do with whether or not we are just people. And they reveal an unjust heart when the person takes a very careless view of these things and says, well, it doesn't matter if they get it on the 10th, doesn't matter if they get it on the 20th. Take a careless view of what we've agreed to because we gave our word, and do not pay is to lie. To not pay is to lie. It is dishonesty. It is robbing the other person of what they have a right to expect from us at a certain time. It is to say, I don't care about your business. I don't care about your employment and your job. I don't care about the number of jobs that your company employs that keep people's well-being intact in this world, and how many children are involved in their families that it supports. I don't care about the great harm that I do. I'm only concerned that I'm not going to pay you on time. I'm just going to let it slide this month. It's a great injustice not to pay bills when they're due. Greg?
You know where commercial grace comes in?
No, there's no commercial grace.
You know, we say doing a person, they're on 50. That's grace. It's grace.
That's been agreed to in advance. And 15th is a deadline, not a dying line. That's been agreed to in advance. Well, when somebody comes to me and says, I know I agreed in advance to pay you on the first, but I can't pay you this month, and I've not agreed to that in advance, they are being an unjust person. I had a person tell me, I can't pay you this month, and we are moving out next month, and we need the money for a down payment on the house we're going to buy. And I said, I'm sorry, you owe me this month's rent. I said, I can't pay it and get that house too. Man is an unjust man. And he had more to me to answer to than just me. He has to answer God for that. It didn't matter how long he was there, or if he paid the rent every month while he was there, that did not alleviate the fact that that month he owed me that money. And no justification for the idea that he was buying a house. Therefore, he could treat me that way, and he had no idea the ramifications it might have upon my life. And the great harm that it would do. Needless to say, it destroyed the trusting relationship that we had had for several years. And we did have one. But for his own personal interests, he would set aside his commitments and commercial justice to serve his own personal good. There was a man who was converted, who after his conversion, people began to observe him. And people begin to think him very miserly. Because he would eat, I think, mostly like radishes or beans or something like that. And he was just appeared to be very miserly. But after about a year or so, it became known finally that that man had been so terrible in his commercial dealings with other people. And had gotten so far behind and so negligent on his business concerns and such, that he deprived himself of the very basic essentials to get to just survive so that he could take all his money every month
and pay off the people that he'd been unjust to. Because he came to see
that in order for God to forgive him, he must be willing to become a just person. And that required that he now make restitution and make things just in his life.
And that necessitated him making great self-denial, to just eating bare minimums and being so frugal that people thought he was a miser. But he was taking care of business.
Commercial justice is extremely important, and this diagram is going to come into play here soon if I'm successful in conveying to you what I want to convey. Justice is attributed to God. Nebuchadnezzar said that God was just. Nebuchadnezzar was thrown out in the wilderness by God for 7 years, lived like an animal, and then God brought back his sanity. And Daniel told him what was going to happen to him. When he came back to his sanity and came back to his throne, he acknowledged God was in the heaven, was God who puts men upon thrones, and that God is a God of justice. Nehemiah acknowledged the same thing about God, a God of justice. David in the 37th Psalm describes God being a God of justice. Moses talks about the justice of God. God commands men and women to be just in the law and in the prophets. As an attribute of God, as justice, is to my mind one of the more beautiful attributes of benevolence. What do we mean by the justice of God? That's elaborated on it using this context here, the scale. Let's talk about justice itself and use the scales and see if we can put together an understanding of what justice is using the scales, but not talking about money. Can we do that? Ron, can we do that? Okay. You want to feed us some information on that? Got anything here?
Both sides of the scale are going to be absolutely equal. We will get, whether good or bad, exactly what we have accumulated in this life and we have done in this life.
Okay. You're still thinking of judgment? Penalty? Let's draw away from penalty and judgment. If one of the attributes of God is benevolence of any being, is justice. And let's assume that the angels were in existence for a long time before there was any sin. Yet justice is in operation in existence. Let's look at that. Let's look at justice so that we can think of God as a just God without necessarily thinking of penalty or punishment. Okay? Because he is just, has always been just. All benevolent beings are just, yet doesn't necessitate that there be sin and punishment for that justice to perpetuate itself, to be exercised. Just as I said in commercial transactions, when a person is diligent to always pay as agreed upon time, he is exercising justice, but there's no penalty or sin involved. You see what I'm saying? How beautiful to see somebody that's so concerned about being just towards that they don't promise something, and then time goes on and time goes on, and then they don't do it. That their word becomes something that you can depend on as much as an angel's word. Because they're just. That's an attribute of justice. That you can, they will not lie and deceive you and steal the truth from you. And you can depend upon their word. You can just, it's certain. A just person's word is certain. So, apart from punishment and penalty, let's develop our understanding of justice apart from that. Because it has a lot to do with something besides penalty and punishment. Pat?
Well, I was thinking on one side the scales could be truth, and on the other side could be conformity. That would be a way of justice, but not punishment.
What do you think about that as a paradigm? What do you think about that as a concept? Using the scales and put on one side put truth, the other side
the
if you've got truth here as a measure, and if it's conformity equal to the truth, you're going to have justice. See that? You see that? Think that's a fair working model? So why would lying be unjust? Okay?
Not conform to truth.
Okay, it's devoid of conformity to truth. So lying would be an unjust thing to do. A liar would be an unjust person because he does not conform his language, his commitments to, he does not speak in terms or commit himself to truth. So he's not conformed to the truth in speaking. What are the attributes can we talk about in this term, these terms, or in this kind of model? What about pride? What about pride? Is pride unjust? Well, that's true. There's no reason to have pride, but it's everywhere.
I know, but it's unjust because God is the only one that can save pride, if I can say it that way.
That's an interesting. Keep going.
It would be unjust for us to have pride because there's no reason for us to. There's no substance in us that can have pride. I mean, we are dust.
Well, what is pride then? Let's ask what pride is. In fact, humility is one of the attributes of benevolence. Pride is one of the attributes of selfishness. So God is not proud. I appreciate you're trying to exercise the words a little bit, but let's not use those outside of proper context. So. Why would pride? What is pride? Let's try to define what pride is. Roslyn, what do you think pride is? Elevated thoughts of self. Can you describe that a little bit more? What kind of thoughts would be elevated thoughts?
One that is not true.
Okay. So, here's what is true about you, and you're thinking something that is other than true about you. So that wouldn't be just, would it? If it is true, X is true about you, but if you elevate your thoughts about yourself and express them to other people and think of yourself more highly than you should, as Paul said, that's pride, thinking of yourself more highly than you should. And if you're thinking of yourself higher than you should, it would be not in conformity to the truth. So that would be unjust. Scales would go tilt. It would be an unjust frame of mind to think of yourself higher than you should because it's not according to what's true about you. Okay?
When you said pride, I instantly thought of the definition for deception. You think that something when it's nothing is deceived. What's the difference between deception and pride? It just depends on what you're deceived in.
Thank you.
with, I think, touch more to pride, thinking that
because the value of his well-being is as valuable as your own and vice versa. Pride says, the truth of me is my interests are more important than my neighbor's. Pride has a disposition and a commitment to the idea that one's own interests are more important than their neighbors. And that is not true. That is an unjust frame of mind, an unjust view of oneself and one's level of importance. What is the truth of the matter? Over here, the truth of the matter is that one should evaluate their importance according to what it really is. Now, let's look at it just a little bit differently. Jesus is referring to justice in many occasions. Many of his parables are an appeal to people's innate sense of justice. Jesus appeals to everyone's innate sense of justice often. What he says, appealing to her sense of justice. That is, the relative importance of various kinds of existences. So rocks are much less important than sheep, and sheep are much less important than human beings, and human beings are much less important in their relative value to God. So, the truth of the matter is, his interests are greater than a sheep, equal to a neighbor, and less than God. And that's the truth. And until the mind of a moral agent commit themselves to that state and evaluation of himself, he's not living by the truth, and he's puffing himself up higher than he should. It's pride. So that a just view of oneself will be according to the truth, and that is more important than a sheep, equal importance as my neighbor, but less important than God's in the interest. Okay?
Scripture.
Okay.
2:3.
Uh-huh.
To do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others.
Yeah. That is only just. It is only just. Because that's the truth. That is a true description of the relative value of interest. So that is just to think that way and to be in that state of mind. In fact, anyone who is not in that state of mind and not in that disposition of heart and not committed to live in that life is an unjust person. For any way to reverse it and think of themselves more highly than they think of their neighbor or look out for their own selves before they look out for their neighbor's good is not living by the truth and therefore is unjust. The scale of tilted. That person doesn't weigh in according to the truth. See that? Good, great scripture, Greg.
Greg? If you can clarify the definition of pride a little bit.
Of what?
Pride. Just like an example, like if my son does something well and I compliment him on it, he is going to have some pride towards that, which I see as not being bad. Is that pride or is that something else that I'm seeing? When someone does something good, good for its own sake, and you feel good about what you've done, is that pride or is that something else?
What's the definition of pride to address that?
I think what we are we setting yourself above what you...
Let's address that in the context of that question so this will help us clarify. Teresa, what do you think?
Well, if pride is an elevation, then to compliment someone according to what's true about what they did would not be, to me, elevated. Like, say, if someone, my son does an art project and it's good, and if I was to say, that is good. I see that you did well by not going out of the line. I would say that is the greatest thing I've ever seen, but if I complimented him and told him according to the truth, then I wouldn't see that as promoting pride to someone.
Does this have to do with performance? Of any kind?
Conformity or pride?
Performance. Does what a person ought to believe is true regarding themselves have to do with performance or something else? What does it have to do with? It has to do with their view of how important their interests are, not how well they perform certain tasks. A person can hear Jesus say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," because it is true. But the thing we're talking about here is, does the person hold a view of their interests higher than they should? Do they consider their interests more important than their neighbor's? More important than God's when it isn't. It's different than having the ability to do certain things and do them well and do extremely well, but you can still remain non-proud but humble in keeping your view of the importance of your interest in the proper, true place. A person may become a greatly developed artist, a pianist or something, and still remain in a state of disposition that their interests are no more important than my neighbor's. Even though I can excel my neighbor in playing the piano, his interests are equal to mine in importance. Mm-hmm. See that?
So if humility is developed, then willingness to be known for your true character, then pride would be unwillingness to be known, in the sense that one would rather believe a lie.
Yeah, that's the essence of what we're talking about. What is not true regarding self. Pride is believing what is not true about what is true about ourselves as moral beings. What is true about you as a moral being is that your interests are no more important than mine and your neighbor's. That is what is true about us because we are moral beings, not because you do anything or don't do anything. When I refuse to believe that, but choose to put my interest and conceive of them and am willing to believe that my interests are more important than my neighbor's and more important than God's, that's pride. Because it is an unjust view. It is a view that is unjust. It is a view that is a lie. Greg, you want to add to that?
Yes, so it's okay to have pride as long as that pride doesn't puff you up and above people to your neighbor or greater than God. I'm trying to figure out, is it okay to have pride? Is it okay to have pride in what you've done? If I do a good job, if I paint this room and I go, I did a good job, is it wrong for me to have pride in the job that I've done?
Well, I don't hear you using the word pride consistently, maybe a little consistently. It's a fact. If a person is an excellent pianist, that's a fact. They shouldn't pretend that it's not a fact. If you paint something and it is a job well done, it's a fact. And you can say that's a fact. The pride is not how you view what you do. Pride is an assessment of your importance higher than it should be. If you say, I painted a place and I did a good job, therefore, people owe me more than what's due me. That they should bow down before me, or that they should give me more recognition than is due me as a moral agent, or such as that. No, then that would be contrary. That would be.
Is that what you're calling pride?
I'm calling pride.
Trying to figure out what is the emotion that I'm feeling when I do a good job.
I don't know. You'll have to look at that. I can't get into your experience. That's something you can look at in comparison to what we're going through tonight.
I think everybody has that emotion. When they do something well, they have an emotion that they've done a good job.
The important thing is to understand what pride is. Grip it firm in your mind that pride is an over-evaluation of your interests compared to what they really are. If you'll nail down what pride is, then you can proceed from there. But I can't start with somebody's emotions and nail down anything. I can't start with my emotions and nail down anything. You can start with what is true and proceed from there. But pride is a willingness to believe that my or your interests are more important than they really are. And what they really are is your interests and mine are equal. Your good and my good are equal in importance. But God is supreme and the sheep is less. To get out of that frame, a reference, and believe something that is different than that is to go into pride and have an unjust view about oneself. So that when God will not bow down from heaven to cater to one individual interest because he deems them much higher than God does, when God doesn't do that, a person gets angry. Because God is not bowing down to their puffed up view of their importance. And they believe that God, running the universe, has really got to keep track of their wishes and wants and comply with them because their well-being is much more important than the universe. Why they're asking God to throw away commercial justice and public justice and deal only with one person's view of themselves. And we've got a world filled with 5 billion people that mostly think that they are more important than anyone else. Teresa?
I definitely see this is true, but I think it's just our worldly view. No one in the world who has pride, whatever, I can't imagine them saying, I have pride because I believe that my interests are more valuable than my neighbor. I think it's just so foreign.
Yes.
It's a new concept for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's maybe where Greg or, you know, we get tripped up. You know, it's just never talked about in that light, but I can see that that must be what it is.
How is it lived out practically?
Is it not self-apparent in practical living?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
But no one would ever admit that. You know, I could just see a talk show, well, you know, my interests are much more valuable than my neighbor. I mean, I just can't imagine somebody, you know, even understanding or saying that.
No, they won't say it quite like this. What they will say is, why did you steal that car? And they'll say, because I wanted it. Why did you shoot that person? Because I wanted to. What they're saying is, what I want is more important than the life of another individual. My desires are of greater interest than the life of another individual.
It's what they say, but coming out and wording the way you do is a lot uglier.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, if they were to actually hear exactly what they were saying,
right,
I think it would take on a whole different view.
Right. Now, you know where this is upheld?
Where is this upheld? This is upheld in this world. Exactly what I said. This definition of pride and accountability to it, this very concept I'm showing you, is upheld every day in this world. This very concept is upheld. Where?
Yeah.
Courts of law. Criminal comes, it doesn't matter what his excuse was.
For killing the person or whatever. By and large,
he is put in his proper place and said, you did not have a right to do that because they had just as much right to live as you do, etc., etc. The person is put in this place, in this just view of themselves in court. If they have committed a crime. They're brought to down to their proper level of importance, and they will say to them, you are not important enough to keep your freedom, since you destroyed so much good in society. You're going to lose your freedom because you are not more important, your interests are not more valuable than the interests of those that you've harmed. It is the courts of law that go back right to this concept I'm telling you about. And 12 good and true sitting on the jury will nail them to this and say, you're right. Regardless of how important you think your views were or what you wanted was, it didn't matter. They had an equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that you do. And we're going to uphold that. In their name, since they're not here, we are going to execute public justice on you for the public good. And it does happen every day.
But there are the individual cases where there's great injustice and pride going on all the time that never gets to the courts because it doesn't fit into the definition of crime under our government, but nonetheless that they sin against God. And this is what's going to happen on Judgment Day. Judgment Day, God's going to say, this is your real value of your interests. It's no different than your neighbor's. You took your neighbor's interests and destroyed them.
Now I'm going to show you how your destruction of his interests look to me. I will show you how terrible your selfishness looked to me by causing you to live in misery
from now on. For the sake of the sinner is one reason that he is condemned to what he is, so that he will see. He will be conscious of the great harm that he exacted upon others in, through his sin. So, there are feelings of satisfaction for accomplishment, things like that.
But you've got to start with a view of pride and work down into the other things. This one can see, and this one can commit themselves to, and the rest will take care of itself.
Any questions on that? What about lying?
Where does lying fit in here? Did we talk about lying in this regard? It's not true. Okay, it doesn't measure up to the truth. It's lying. It's unjust. Can you think of some other attributes of sin that we put in here?
Dishonesty.
What about unbelief?
Is unbelief unjust? Is unbelief unjust?
Here's the truth of God, the truth about God, revealed through Jesus Christ, revealed through the Scriptures, revealed through creation, revealed through our own mind and reason. And yet, we believe something that is not according to the truth. Believe in something contrary to the truth, even when you know what the truth is unbelief. And since it doesn't weigh out with what is true, that is unjust to be in unbelief. Unbelief is an injustice because it does not weigh in with truth. Yes?
Unbelief is kind of like a lie also, isn't it? When you're unbelief, you're saying that the truth is a lie.
Unbelief is practicing lie. Yeah, unbelief is calling the truth a lie. And it's unjust.
God is just because He lives according to what is true about Him. Is true to His word, is true to His character, is true to His nature, is true to Himself. Let God be true, if every man has to be a liar, let God be known to be true. God is just because He lives according to what is true about Himself and His reason and His nature and His character. So God is just. And He upholds justice by making sure that all beings that He has created live according to what is true about them as moral agents. Not what is true about them, but what they've accomplished or things like that. But what is true about them in terms of the value of their importance and the value of their interests. So in the administration of His justice includes the fact that He is just and He administers a government to make sure that all other beings live according to what is true about the value of their interests. That's what He's administering in His government. So that anyone who would live contrary to what is true about the value of their interests would, in fact, be unjust, and He would have to deal with that unjust person. See that? Okay.
As you pointed out, it also demonstrates the injustice of sin, how greatly unjust it is.
Mm-hmm.
In one respect, as Greg talks about a lie, what is true about God and knowing it and refusing to conform to it but believe something that is not true about God is to yell at God, in effect, yell at God and say, "You are not what you are. You are what I think or choose to believe you are. You are not good because I am not willing to believe you, therefore you are not trustworthy. You are not just because your law inhibits my selfishness and that is not just. So I don't believe you're just. You are not trustworthy because you don't give me everything I want. If you were trustworthy, you would yield to my desires and wishes." And pretty soon, a construction, a view of God is constructed through selfishness that views God as unjust because it does not yield to the selfish heart.
Let me divert for a moment. Keep thinking on this. Let me ask another question. Is gossip unjust? What's the unjust injustice of gossip? Kim? Okay. So your view of another person is not according to the truth. It's unjust. And the only way really to secure enough knowledge of the truth of another person is to be close enough to really get the information firsthand, or withhold any opinion until you can confirm what you've heard. But to gossip is to be spreading information about another person that you've heard about another person and you don't know it's true for sure. This is the end of side one. Side two now begins. To treat another person's reputation so carelessly as to be willing to tell something you're not sure is true about them is to be willing to be unjust to their reputation. To be unjust to their reputation is no different than being unjust to their pocketbook. They're thinking that conviction is something to be avoided because they're going further away from God, the more guilt that they sense that they have and what they deserve. They think they're going away from God. In fact, it is the way God intends to take them. But they start to resist the awakening. They start to resist what is really true about their sin. They start to resist what is really true about God's justice and righteous character. And these laws, and they start to resist that and push it down as though it is an evidence that they're just going too far away from God. And they want to have this sense of being close to God, and this feeling of being close to God. And the only way to do that is to go back to their careless and indifferent state in their mind. Not recognizing that they've got to get past this into this in order to get to converted. They think that they're being disturbed and they've got to deaden the disturbance so that they can go back to what they think is a converted state. So they don't contemplate that the awakening that God does through various agencies and the Word of God and the law of God and circumstances is to awaken them to the point where they give up all hope. Of eternal life as a sinner. All hope. The converted person has gotten past any hope. He's beyond the point of no return as far as any hope before God of rectifying his sin and nullifying the fact that he's guilty and he deserves eternal punishment. The sinner can wrestle with and wrestle with and wrestle with and wrestle with and try to nullify and do and make up for and rectify his sin and his guilt so that at some point he has the hope that he can nullify the guilt and nullify the penalty and the punishment that he deserved him. And therefore, once he gets past that point, he can have peace with God. But that's the opposite direction God would take a person. God is trying to take a person to see that they are past the point of rectifying things. They are past the point of making up for things. They are past the point of guilt. They will forever be guilty. They will forever deserve condemnation. And once a person finally throws up their hands and agrees with God, it is all over forever, then God can convert them. Then God can convert them. But as long as the sinner is wrestling with this conviction and trying to throw it down and trying to kill it and trying to nullify it, thinking that's the way to peace by getting rid of the guilt and the conviction, is working against God. God was going to bring them to show them that they are in fact beyond hope. Only hope that God will be merciful to them. If there's any other hope than that, they're wrestling against what God has for them. It will be true forever that every person that God saves and gives mercy to will forever be guilty. Justification is not the elimination of guilt and the pronouncement that that person is not guilty. It will be ever true that the person knows that they deserve everlasting torment. And that would have been the righteous thing for God to do if mercy had not triumphed over justice. So people can labor under their own plan of salvation, concocted in their own mind, put together what they've heard people say of how to get to that point with peace with God, and they try to piece it together, but they're resisting the Holy Spirit, who is trying to bring them to a point of absolute hopelessness, and they're trying to resist that, thinking that if they ever get to that point where they throw up their hands and say, I know it is absolutely hopeless as far as getting salvation from God by rectifying my past, once they get to that point, they're willing to step over and say, it is forever hopeless. I can't go back and make it up for it. I can't go back and rectify it. It is a lost cause, and I am lost, and now I admit it. I am willing to believe what God says is true about me. I'm willing to be just in my view of myself and acknowledge I have ever forever forfeited the right to eternal life by making up for my sin. My sin is greater than anything that I can do to nullify it. Own it. Sinners got to own it. And God's trying to bring you to the point of owning his sin and standing up before a court of God's justice and say, instead of people who stand up there and say, not guilty, Your Honor, and hire 50 lawyers, it cost them $5 million so that they can try to get out of what they are guilty of. The sinner is, God is trying to wake the sinner to come up and stand up before God on his own and say, I am lost. And God, your justice I justify. And I believe in your righteousness. And if your kingdom and your interests are best served by sending me to hell, I am willing to live according to your justice willingly. If that best serves your interest, God, that I not have mercy, I'm willing to do that. You've revealed that mercy is your will, and I'm willing to be saved by mercy. If you can't bring me to repentance and faith, if I'm not willing to do that, then God, I'm willing to have your justice. Because there's nothing wrong with you. The fault has all been mine. Until the sinner comes and justifies God, what God has to do to the sinner, then the sinner cannot receive mercy. When people describe their wrestlings and their awakenings and their convictions, they don't need the comfort of, oh, let's make sure that this gets settled down. Let's make sure that this gets quieted down because that's just leading you away from God. No, it's not. It's God trying to get the sinner's agreement with what is true. He is a hopeless case under law. He is forever guilty and can never be not guilty. And he's trying to get the sinner to admit that. And to justify God for what God has to do to him if he will not repent. Is God righteous? Is God righteous, Ron? What does that mean? What does that mean? God is righteous?
He is perfectly conformed to the truth.
He's perfectly conformed to the truth. What truth? What truth? Specifically. Keep well then? Moral law. Moral law is the measure of righteousness. God is perfectly conformed in thought, word, and deed, in the state of his will, to what the moral law demands. He is therefore righteous because, as a being, his will, his whole being, is devoted to what the law commands a moral being to be devoted to. Therefore, he is righteous. What is true about God is that he must be entirely benevolent, disinterestedly benevolent. That is what's true about God.
God is, in fact, entirely in conformity to that truth. Therefore, he is righteous and he is just. What the law commands him, he is entirely conformed to it. He is therefore just. Scales are balanced. He's always been just. His treatment of every human being in our whole race is just. And the marvelous thing of it is, that somewhere in God's great infinite wisdom, moved by his great benevolence, God constructed an atonement. That when God punishes the sinner who is unrepentant, he is just in doing so, because that's what the law would require. And when the sinner is repentant and does have faith in God, because of Jesus and his death, his atonement, God can not punish the sinner and still remain righteous and just. Because public justice has been served through the death of Christ. So that he, if we confess our sins, is faithful and just to forgive them and cleanse us from all unrighteousness because of the blood of Christ. God does not set aside the law in any manner when he forgives a sinner. He sets aside punishment of the law because the death of Christ answers to and fulfills the same end that punishment would serve. So the end and the purposes of law served through the death of Christ, and the sinner is pardoned by the mercy of God. So as Paul would say, the depths of the wisdom of God. It's unsurpassed. We could never have conceived of a plan whereby God remains righteous and yet sinners are not punished. But God did. And God remains just in doing so. You know the trouble that some of you have with upholding your family laws and punishment and discipline and things like that? And, you know, if you don't punish, what kind of signal it says. And if you do punish, you know it's necessary, but all that? Well, God has the same kind of problem. If he doesn't punish the sinner, the rest of the universe says, I guess he doesn't care about sin. If he does punish every sinner, then we're all lost and doomed. But his love and his wisdom concocted and conceived a scheme whereby God, through the death of Jesus, is just in not punishing the sinner who repents and believes. So that his justice is not harmed, that the law is not harmed, and yet the sinner also is not harmed, who deserved to be harmed. Where does the harm go? Jesus was harmed. Great harm was given unto Jesus. He bore our sins. He suffered the just for the unjust. He wasn't punished for them. He wasn't punished for us. But he suffered great harm and suffering. So that we would not have to, if we would believe. God is just because what is true about him and what he is committed to are the same thing. And we are unjust if we are not conformed to the truth. So, unbelief, gossiping, pride, so many of those things we've talked about, you can see them as unjust because they don't match up and they're not conformed to what is true about the value of our interests and how important we are and our interests are. And God would be unjust to demand of us what we could not do. It would be unjust to not fulfill promises he makes if the conditions are met. Justice is an attribute of benevolence. Because benevolence is living according to the truth. It's a
commitment to abide by the truth, conform to the truth. Any questions on that? If God did not live according to the truth all times, He would not be just and would not be trustworthy. Here's where faith is related to this whole subject. If God is not just, He's not trustworthy. But if He is just, and the Bible declares He's just, and Jesus declared that the Father is just, and our own minds affirm that God is just, to conceive of God not being just is not to conceive of God. With all that being true, then He is trustworthy. If God is trustworthy and we do not trust, we are unjust. So it's not just a matter of doctrine, whether or not we understand a doctrine, or whether or not we're in agreement with a doctrine or something. The issue is, God is trustworthy because He's just, righteous. Do we trust Him? If not, that reveals our injustice. It does not reveal the injustice of God. But we have a sure foundation to trust Him. Because His character is one conformed to the truth and is trustworthy. Okay, any questions? Greg?
So, a comment that you said that if you don't believe that God is just, you don't believe God at all. That's the problem. They don't believe that God is just. So they cast God in the world and say they believe, quote unquote, God. They can't, they don't see this as being just because they're just, it's just because they decide it's wrong. That's a very good point.
The world in which God created it offers many occasions of inconsistencies that appear unjust. The existence of the wicked continuing on, the flourishing, the prosperity of the wicked doesn't seem just. It doesn't seem just for innocent children to be treated the way they are by parents and etc. and abused. It doesn't seem just. If God is a God of justice and of love, why doesn't He do something about it? Questions? And that's greatly tempting and has kept people from cause people to struggle with that and is a stumbling block for those who do not have faith. To those who have faith, those things can be answered by factoring in the will of man and the sinfulness of man. But what appears to be injustice in this world, in my mind, is a proof of a life hereafter. Much like the thinking of those who come up with karma, but not for the same reason. Because there is injustice in this world and justice is not meted out in this world, because there is a God that I know exists in my confidence, there must therefore be a life after this in which people are made to account injustice for their sin. Because they don't pay for it here. That's obvious. So there must be a day of reckoning coming. If God is just, there must be a day of judgment.